on the next slide.
Put the cursor and we'll play.
All right, so anyway, welcome everybody. And we're going to play a little brief video about the history of the Highline, the Highline Park, which relates to the increasing land values on the far west side that we're focusing on here.
This historic elevated railway is now as New York's part of the sky. It's a mile and a half of meandering pathways, lush plantings, and dramatic design cutting through the heart of the meatpacking district in West Chelsea. But the High Line was once a bustling railroad, part of the industrial fabric of Manhattan's West Side. In the 1800s, railroad tracks ran down the West Side waterfront, bringing goods to the factories and warehouses. The streets were crowded and the trains were dangerous. They caused so many accidents that 10th Avenue was nicknamed Dead Avenue. The railroad hired men on horseback to ride in front of every train. Each waved a red flag to warn pedestrians out of the way. These men were called the West Side Cowboys. The High Line was built in the 1930s, part of a massive infrastructure project called the West Side Improvement, with its giant steel beams lifting freight trains 30 feet in the air. The High Line brought the New York Central Railroad right through the upper floors of factory and warehouse buildings. Trains in the High Line carried meat to the meatpacking district, baking supplies to the National Biscuit Company or Nabisco, now Chelsea Market, and many other goods to the West Side. But within just a few decades, more and more freight began to travel by trucks on the new interstate highway system. Rail traffic declined on the High Line. Part of it was torn down in the 1960s. The last train ran down the High Line before Thanksgiving in 1980, carrying three boxcars full of frozen turkeys. After the train stopped running, the High Line sat unused, a rusty monument to the West Side's industrial past. On top of the tracks, nature began to take hold. The wind blew seeds in from across the river, and birds dropped others onto the railway. Some of these seeds took root, grew, died, and decomposed. A layer of soil built up. And as the years passed, a strange, unlikely wilderness took hold. Grasses, wildflowers, and trees grew up, watered by the rain, sheltered by buildings, virtually untouched by humans. But on the ground, the property owners of West Chelsea began to lobby the city to have the High Line torn down. They called it a blight and an eyesore. In 1999, two neighborhood residents, Robert Hammond and Joshua David, met at a community meeting about the future of the High Line. They heard that the structure might be torn down and wanted to see if anyone was trying to save it. Nobody was, so they started Friends of the High Line, a nonprofit group. At first, saving the High Line was an unlikely dream. Mayor Giuliani signed demolition orders, and few people thought the High Line could be preserved. But over the next few years, Friends of the High Line brought together a community of artists, architects, business owners, and civic leaders to rally for the High Line. The city government got behind the project in 2002. 3 years later, the project was approved. After an international competition, the design team, led by field operations Giller, Scafidio, and Renfro, began to plan the High Line's transformation to a public park. For more information about the High Line, or to become a member of Friends of the High Line, please visit thehighline.org.
Good evening. Welcome to the two secret pillars of capitalism. My name is Don Butterfield, and I will be your moderator on the panel tonight. The two pillars are major forces controlling our economy, land and money. The first two speakers will discuss land and money from a conceptual point of view. The last two speakers will provide concrete examples right here in New York City. Anthony Prasad will be our first speaker on land reform. Ron Rubin will be the next speaker discussing monetary reform. And before we go on to examples of how these reforms can be implemented, we invite you to ask questions for 15 minutes. Then Alan, over here, will describe rising land values on Manhattan's west side around the Hudson Yards development, which is just north of the island we just saw. He will compare this to their development, applying the concepts of land reform. After him, Sue Peters will discuss the current funding of the Hudson Yards development, followed by how funding would work if it was done by monetary reform. Finally, we will devote the last 15 minutes to answering more of your questions.
Thank you, Ron, for the Don, for the introduction. My name is Anthony Prasad, and I'm going to be focusing on a section that talks about a conceptual point of view about land. That will lead into Ron's conceptual point of view about money, and Alan and Sue will give some practical examples of how this works in regards to the Hudson Yards and the High Line from the video you just saw. We begin with this poem, and I just want you to take a quick second to read it. So, this poem, I think it's pretty self-explanatory when we talk about land, as I will talk about in this part of the presentation. So, just to give you a framework of how I'm going to approach this issue of land, going to connect land, talk about it from the point of view of it being a natural, the natural universe, also that all humanity should share in it, and how we should, how we can share in this, given those two ideas. So, before we start talking about land, which is our issue, we have to sort of establish a definition. And classical economists have a technical term that they use for the definition of land, and it goes something like this. The entire material, physical, that is, universe, excluding people and their products. So land is the entire material, physical universe, right? So some examples of that would be things that are in their natural state. So we have the entire material universe, we have the entire land mass of the planet, we have the planet itself, with all the different global positioning systems, including the International Space Station, which astronauts use as a launching pad for servicing all of the GPS systems. That's all part of land. We have things like natural, things like lakes and rivers, you know, different types of grains. What is that? Forests, diamonds. Natural resource, fossil fuels, oil, coal, gas, metals like silver, gold, and other types of metals that are used in the economy for building certain types of things. So those are some examples of land, and these things are found in nature, and they're found naturally. They're naturally occurring things. So we have to ask the question, if we're going to talk about land, what is the importance of land? Why are we putting so much focus on it or emphasis on it? So these are some points here as to why land is important. Land is common to all human beings. Land is limited. We're not making any more of it, as far as I know. It is where we extract all natural resources, which we ultimately use for economic activities. So all products that we use in our world, they came from somewhere, right? And also very important, land provides for all basic human needs. Food, clothing, and shelter. So that's why land is important. And another reason why land is important, this little nice little cartoon here that says, religious freedom is my immediate goal, but my long-range plan is to go into real estate. Now, that's a very provocative quote there, and it's quite funny, and also there's a lot of truth behind it, right? Location, location, location. So, we have the issue, which is land. So now we're going to talk a little bit about the problem. So what is the problem with land? And historically, land has always been used for various reasons, leading back to the previous slide about why it's important. So here are some things that I've kind of consolidated. So land is pretty much used in every human civilization on the planet, right? And it was controlled by a few privileged individuals. Chiefs, kings, queens, the aristocracy, the Catholic Church. And you know, there were various legal systems that codified how this land was, you know, owned by that privileged group. We also have the enclosure movements, which pretty much started in England around 1235 AD, and it also spread to the rest of Europe. It also took on a different shape in the 17th century, 1604. It was called the Enclosures rather than an E, it's an I, Enclosures Act. And that lasted until 1914. And just a little bit of information there about what actually happened. Lots of land was pretty much enclosed, about 6.8 million acres. Then after after the Americas were discovered, we had colonialism. So we had a different phase of enclosures, practically, that moved into the New World. Certain types of practices like land grants were practiced, where land were basically given to the conquistadors. Those were referred to as haciendas, which are basically large portions of lands. And during the time of Greece and Rome, they were referred to as latifundia, basically big plots of land that are owned and controlled by very few people. And then moving into the formation of the United States after the Civil War, we had the Homestead Act, which was passed in 1862 under the Lincoln administration. And it basically gave applications for applicants to apply for about, at the time it was 160 acres of land. That's about 12 square blocks, to be exact. We calculated it, Ron and I. Later on, that act was enlarged in 1909, and it doubled the amount of land that was allotted to individuals who applied. There was certain criteria for your application. Later on, it was also increased in the stock raising. That's actually the National Stock Raising Act of 1916. It also increased the size of acreage that was given out. And in 1976, the Homestead Act actually came to an end. It sort of manifested into different forms in Alaska, which led to the giveaway of additional lands there. Prior to that, of course, we had corporations that were chartered, that were basically sent to the New World to... So this is a problem that we have with land. Very important, because this leads up to Alan's presentation about Hudson Yards and High Line, and Sue's presentation about the financing of it. So additional problems. Land ownership also creates various societal problems, of which wars, slavery, environmental degradation, which is a huge issue today, and of course, poverty, which is widespread because land is controlled by very few people, it leads to poverty, widespread poverty. We all know this if we come to the Henry George School, we talk a lot about it. So the real problem, however, is that land values that are publicly created are captured and expropriated by private interests. And we'll see some practical examples in Alan's presentation as to how this happens exactly. So that's our problem. So just a few questions to consider as we move along to further along the presentation. So urban land values, what do you think this is worth? These pictures here are pretty good, captures pretty well the concentration of various locations in New York City. You know, this is downtown, World Trade Center. This is Central Park and everything around it. This is Long Island City, which is still developing as we speak. Many more buildings are scheduled to be built. And this is the Hudson Yards. This is a rendering of what the Hudson Yards will look like. One of the largest developments in the United States to date. So,
who's going to be developing it? Trump?
Alan is actually going to talk in much more detail about Hudson Yards.
Okay.
I'm just giving you a conceptual framework of how to think about land so that it'll make a lot more sense when Alan talks about it.
Is the Hudson Yards the West Side development
thing
over there?
It's
called after.
Yeah, but Alan will give you all the details about exactly what it is, the corporation that's associated with it, and all that stuff. So speaking of land values, what really determines land values? So all those slides I just showed you, these are all locations, right? The locations are what determine the land value. And the natural characteristics of those locations are also what creates value in that land. We also have the contributions of the community, both past and present, that contributes to the value of the land. And usually we can look at the price of land to get a good reflection of what its value is. So in regards to the price of land, we have to ask some questions as to the value, what creates the value, and looking at the price to get an understanding of, you know, what creates the value. So a few questions to consider. What creates the desirability of specific locations? Who pays in the last analysis? Who receives it? Who should receive it? These are some important questions to consider, because when we talk about the Hudson Yards, these are important questions to ask in regards to that huge development. So, given all that I've said about land and its, you know, value of locations, we believe that the community should share the land value, should share the value of the land, called the land value. Why they should share the value? Because it was created by the community. And how do we share this? Well, we have to radically reform the tax system. And by doing so, we eliminate all taxes, sales, income, and other types of taxes. And we will replace it with the collection of land values to meet the needs of the community. So that's our solution. And I will let Ron now introduce his section in terms of money. And I think we'll take questions after your presentation.
Sounds good.
Okay, cool. So thank you guys.
Okay.
Bottom one is
thank you, Anthony. Good evening, everyone. So
Anthony spoke about land, which is probably something that you probably never think of during the day. Probably been months before you thought of the idea of land. What I'm going to speak about is something that I guarantee you think about every single day. Money. But what I want to talk about in the brief time I have is some of the things that you rarely think about money. So I'm going to take advantage of these few minutes to bring up a couple of topics that you probably have not given much thought to. So let's start out. I don't know. Is there anybody who can't read it? If so, okay. So the caption says, "You'll see. This is going to cause real trouble." Okay. So. Okay. This is a quote from Friedrich Nietzsche, who sort of summarized it. He says, "Money is the crowbar of power." So the three topics and questions that I would like to cover during this our little section here are, first of all, what is the nature of money? Something that perhaps you've never really thought about. The other question is, how is that money created? And the third one is, what might be an alternative way to create it, a radical reform for how the money is actually created. So let's start with the nature of money. What is the nature of money? Normally when we think of money, the first thing that probably comes to mind is the form that it takes. So various dollar bills, coins, currency, that's the kind of thing, plus checks, your checkbook. Those are the kind of things that people normally think if you ask them, what is money, that would be the first thing that popped into their mind. But that's just the form. That's really not what money is. So let's go a little deeper into this question of what money is and ask, is money wealth? Let's take a very quick survey. How many people think that money is wealth? This is a very astute, except for our one devil's advocate in the corner there. All right, well.
Try doing it without it.
So let's just, this is such a privileged group, we'll run through this very quickly. So what is wealth? Basically goods and services, okay? So cars and tables and houses and services like nurses and transitive people and school teachers. That's normally what we think of as wealth. Is money wealth? He said no, okay? So if money's not wealth, and it's not just simply the form that it takes, then what is money? The ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle, generally acknowledged as the originator of the science of money, claimed that, quote, money exists not by nature, but by law. So let's consider that. Let's get another version of this. This was by George Knapp, who wrote a book in 1905 called The State Theory of Money, which was very influential. It was considered part of what became known as the Carlist movement or the state theory of money. And what he said is, "I hold the attempt to deduce the nature of money without the idea of the state to be not only out of date, but even absurd." So the suggestion is that Aristotle said that money is a creature of the law, and Knapp is backing him up and saying it's the state. Behind the law is the state. So, now we come to a definition of money that seems, in my study of it, seems to make sense. To define money as simply a legal claim to wealth. So it acknowledges the fact that money is not wealth, but it's a claim to wealth, and it's a legal claim. It's backed up by the state. So if you think of money that way, then it might help you to consider some of the questions that we're going to look at in a moment. So there it is, money is a legal claim to wealth. So if you have, if you have this guy over here, then you can get these guys over there. That's as simple as it is. You might even think of it even simpler. It's just a claim check on the wealth. Okay? So, now I want to get to the second question, having established the nature of money, what money is. The next question is, how is money created? Now, I don't know about you, but my parents never taught me anything about this. We never talked about it. As a matter of fact, the most detailed explanation I ever got about money is my mother telling me it doesn't grow on trees. That was about as technical as they got at home. And quite frankly, all throughout school, that knowledge was never advanced beyond that rudimentary knowledge that money didn't grow on trees. And if you think about it, in your schooling, you probably would never had a class and went into any details about the nature of money and how it was created. So it was the kind of thing that you knew you needed it, but you didn't know where the heck it came from or what the heck it was, but you knew you needed it. It was important. So what we want to look at is how it's actually created. Where does it come from? If it doesn't grow on trees, this is worth spending a minute on, this quote, because Bernard Leterre, who wrote a book called Rethinking Money, says it very well in this quote. So it's worth spending a few moments on this quote. It says, little thing here, doesn't really work, forget about it. National currencies are now technically defined as fiat money. Fiat takes its origin in the very first word that God spoke in the Latin version of Genesis. Fiat lux, let light be. It implies the godlike ability to create something out of nothing. Ex nihilo, the Latin term, through the power of the word. This means that money isn't something that comes out of a farm, a mine, a mint, or even a printing press. It comes into being by the power of the word, or in these times, a stroke of a computer key. So sometimes the Latin for some reason it always seems to come in very handy. But if you remember these two are kind of key terms when you're thinking about money. One is fiat, it's just by the power of the word, it creates ex nihilo, out of nothing. One moment nothing, next minute it's created by the word. So let's look just briefly at how this actually works in a little bit of detail. Normally, this is how people think it works. First, you go to a bank. How's this going to work? Yeah. And you put a deposit in. Then, somebody else comes to the bank and takes that money out as a loan. That's how most people think banks work. Well, the answer is no. This is not how banks work. In fact, it's the exact opposite. First, somebody comes in to take out a loan. The loan creates a deposit. What does this mean? This means, in effect, the bank didn't have the money when you came in to loan it. You said, I want to borrow some money, and you sign it. The bank creates it. The bank creates money? Yes, because the bank has the fiat power. It has a godlike power to create ex nihilo, out of nothing, money. Money that did not exist before the borrower signed the loan agreement. So this is how it actually works. How do I know? Who knew about this private takeover of our money? How do I know it's true? Well, Robert B. Anderson, who was the Secretary of the Treasury under President Eisenhower, said it very clearly. When a bank makes a loan, it simply adds to the borrower's deposit account in the bank by the amount of the loan. The money is not taken from anyone else's deposit. It's new money. created by the bank for the use of the borrower. So, the total money supply, 97% of it, that's what we're concerned with, is the money that's created by the bank represents 97% of the money in circulation. Okay? Now, why is it a problem that the bank creates 97% of our money? Well, there's a whole list of problems. We'll go through them very briefly. Oh, you got to hold it. Okay. So, problems that are created by because the banks create our money for us. One, if money is created as debt, which we said money is only created when people come to take loans, then the only way to create more money is to create more debt. That's not a good situation to be in. Two, in good times, banks create too much money, which results in booms. In bad times, banks do not create enough money, which results in busts. These boom-bust cycles repeat themselves over and over. Another problem, austerity. The idea that there is not enough money is simply a bank-created problem, because if money can be created ex nihilo, how can you ever say there's not enough money? There's not enough money because the banks are not creating enough money for the proper purposes. That's why there's not enough money. When a bank creates a loan, the interest on the loan is not created. So where does the interest come from? More loans. It's the only place to get the interest from. If the bank didn't create it, it has to create more loans. So you've got this self-perpetuating system of constantly accelerating creation of money. And the last problem, another big problem, is that private banks decide who receives and who doesn't receive loans. We've all heard of things like redlining, where certain neighborhoods are sort of redlined out and the banks are not interested in loaning to those people in those neighborhoods. That's just one typical example of how the banks decide who gets money and who doesn't get money. So these are a whole series of problems that arise from banks creating our money. So, God damn it, Kimball, for us, Main Street is Wall Street. I think that sort of summarizes the attitude of the bankers. They're not really interested in Main Street, are they? They're really interested in Wall Street. That's all their concern is. So, the last part is to just speak briefly about how we could change it. What would be a radical reform? Radical is a word that means going to the root. So we want to go to the root of the problem. We don't want to just chink around the perimeter for some cosmetic changes. We want to get to the root of the problem. So the system concentrates wealth, and here's a quote from William Lloyd Mackenzie King, 10th Prime Minister of Canada. Until the control of the issue of money is restored to government and recognized as its most sacred responsibility, all talk of the sovereignty of Parliament and of democracy is idle and foolish. So here's the solution. That's the whole solution. See how simple it is? I got it all on one slide. Just three things have to be done. Just three simple things, and the money problem is solved. One, we have to bring the Federal Reserve directly under government control. In case some of you are not familiar with it, even though Federal Reserve sounds like it's a government agency, it's sort of like Federal Reserve. It has the word in it, but for the most part, it's a quasi-government agency, but in reality, it decides independently of what Congress wants it to do. It decides what it wants to do, and the system as a whole is really the banker's bank, so you can imagine who in the end they're working for. The second pillar of the solution is to end fractional reserve banking. Fractional reserve banking is the system by which banks can create money out of nothing. They simply have reserves, and according to the system, if you have so many reserves, you can create so much more money, which is all a myth. It doesn't work that way. In practice, the reality is the banks create as much money as they want to. And if they don't have enough reserves, they just go and borrow it from the main bank that
almost no interest. So they're not really held back by reserves. And the third solution is, if the banks are not going to create money, well, where's the money going to come from? Well, the third part of the solution answers that. It's going to come from we the peoples. The government is going to take over the creation of the money. It's going to produce the money. First of all, as debt-free, banks only create money as debt. So government-created money will be debt-free. And since it's not being lent, there's no interest. So the government will be creating debt-free, interest-free money. You might imagine some of the advantages that might have in the overall economy. I'll leave that to your imagination. All three of these were introduced in the 112th Congress, when Dennis Kucinich was still a senator, along with John Conyers. It's in for 2 years and then it has to be renewed. But there was an act called H.R. 2990, which is called the NEED Act, the National Emergency Employment and Defense Act, which had all these aspects in it. So we've come a long way as far as possibly getting something like this to happen. Okay. Is it possible? I don't know if you can't say this is good news. I hear the paradigm is shifting. So, this is the last slide, and this is from George Sigel, who wrote a book called The Philosophy of Money. And he said, "The debate on the future of money is not about inflation or deflation, fixed or flexible exchange rates, gold or paper standards, but about the kind of society in which money is to operate." So there is, I hope I've shed a little bit more light on the topic of money, and I guess Don will moderate, and Alan and Anthony and I will take some questions if you have any.
Yeah. If you have any questions now, address them to the speakers, and anyone have any questions?
That's be somebody on reserve, is that right? That's be somebody on reserve, or lend out the money, as you just said?